Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 178th video cast, 168th podcast for the week ending March 16th, 2023. We're going to do this week a little differently. We're going to spend a lot more time going into the financials of businesses versus the headline noise that you're hearing every day. And for those of you who have been on vacation for the last week, don't worry, you didn't miss anything. It was a very quiet week in the market, but we'll cover some of that as well. So first we'll do the media and then we'll get right to it. I want to thank Charles Payne. I want to thank Kayla Aristivo, Nicholas Palazzo, and Hadia Khan for having me on Making Money with Charles Payne on Fox Business today. We did it live in the studio. It was the first standing up interview I ever did, which was a lot of fun. And we're going to cover this because it covered some very salient points as well as some new picks. So we're going to cut to it right now.
In fact, JP Morgan noted that this new bank term funding program is likely to be too big. And that could be an understatement because it can inject up to $2 trillion, $2 trillion in funds into the banking system. So that presents a paradox for the Federal Reserve, which, of course, on one hand, they're trying to slow down the economy with rate hikes and quantitative tightening. But what happens with this? What if this is quantitative easing? It's crazy. It's so crazy. So it's just good. It's par for the course. 2023 has been a year of crazy. I want to bring in now Great Hill Capital Chairman Thomas Hayes. And, you know, I saw your note and this new program, you said if this had been in place, this new bank term funding program, yeah. If it was in place, let's say, a couple of weeks ago, we wouldn't have had the failures at Silicon Valley Bank and some of the others. But what about the notion that it's a lot of money out there and it could actually backfire?
Yeah, well, you know, the Fed basically created this. So they did all the bond buying, which forced the banks out on the risk curve to buy 5.7-year duration. And then they blew them up with the quantitative tightening, the steepest tightening in the history of the Federal Reserve. So it's kind of like an insurance company. They sell you a policy on your home, then they burn down your home, and then they say, Charles, what did you do to your home before they pay you out? So the tightening cycle is basically over. And to your point, this $2 trillion facility, had it been in place, if they could borrow against the par value of their bonds, we wouldn't have had this situation last week. It certainly was mismanaged. They could have managed the duration better, but this is going to create a lot of stability. The problem you have now, Charles, is if you're a small businessman and you've got $1 million in your checking account and there's not an explicit backstop on those deposits, sure, now, you're going to see a lot of flows into the bigger banks.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm going to get more into that later because something Janet Yellen said today makes that even worse, to your point. About a week ago, last week, The Economist had a pretty good article. The Federal Reserve's $2.5 trillion question upon, what's the future monetary policy rests. And essentially, they're saying, can they suck out $2.5 trillion from the economy and nobody notices? Do you actually believe this is where the Fed's been making a mistake? Instead of hiking rates, they should have been focused more on this.
No question. We're ending the tightening cycle in the next week or so, and we still have $8.3 trillion on the balance sheet, up from $4 trillion. So what we've been saying for many months is that they should have gone more moderately on the rate hikes, maybe stop around 3.5, but they could have brought that balance sheet down by a few trillion dollars so we've got some bullets for the next crisis.
You know, it's just really amazing if you think it's going to take a few years to get to your target, right? I mean, why are you clobbering the economy so hard at the very beginning? Yeah. All right, let's talk about some of the things you like, because speaking of banks, you're buying a bank right now.
Yeah, we bought Bank of America yesterday. It's trading below book, trading at 8x forward, and they're going to be a beneficiary of some of these deposits. Until there's an explicit guarantee for these business people that have larger than insured deposits, we're going to see more and more flows into the big banks, so we like Bank of America.
I got to tell you, it's so crazy. I should have put a screen up for Bank of America. Chase, what they're giving savers and depositors is squat.
Right.
Squat. Right. Imagine, like, you leave a community bank where you're getting a pretty hefty, nice return because of the safety of these banks, and they're just taking advantage of you. All right, you got a couple other ideas you like as well.
Yeah, I think Amazon is a no-brainer. As yields come down now that we're basically towards the end of the tightening cycle, we like Amazon. You can buy it at 2018 prices. They've tripled the AWS. They've tripled the ad business. They've doubled the e-commerce business. They've increased operating cash flow by 50%, and you can buy it for the same price. We like Google. They're trading at 15.2 times next year's earnings, 20% earnings growth. They've got all the AI that Amazon does, Microsoft does. It's just not.
So you're not worried about Bing being a Google killer?
No, not at all. Not at all. And they've got all the AI, and it's a high quality business at a reasonable price.
Right.
And finally, I like PayPal, which has been left for dead. It's trading at 13 times forward earnings.
Yeah.
They've been compounding capital at mid-teens for the last 5 years. We think now, management, you've got some stability. Even if margins compress a little bit, the nominal value of that ticket with inflation at 3, 4, 5% is going to continue to grow, so we like that.
I tell you, man, you're a fresh thinker, and you got great ideas, and I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Thomas.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
All right, folks, now, my next guest says that markets are...
And we're back. Moving right along, I want to thank Fitria Agrani and Sirifa Dwi Rama for having me on CNBC Closing Bell Indonesia on Tuesday morning at 5:30 a.m., by the way. Thank God for daylight savings times. It used to be 4:30 a.m. And that one was a really worthwhile interview because that was happening right in the middle of everything happening with the bank. So if you want a chronology on what happened and what to make of it, you can listen to that on your own time. I also want to thank Phil Yin and Tufik Gibran for having me on CGT in America on Tuesday night. This one we're going to play because it covered some good information on inflation, on picks, on what was happening in the midst. So here we go.
All right, we're joined by Thomas Hayes, our good friend from the chairman and managing member of Great Hill Capital. We got to get through banks, inflation, rates, and your top picks. So let's start with banks. What the heck happened with SVB? I think we have a general analysis on it, but I feel like it's bled through to the other banks. There's obviously been an impact. The banks came back a little bit, but there is still some drama yet to be unfolded.
Well, Phil, like Warren Buffett says, you never know who's swimming naked until the tide comes out. And that's exactly what happened with Silicon Valley Bank. They had the highest percentage of uninsured deposits at 97%. It was all hot money. They cater to startups and venture capital funds. So the minute they had a whiff that there was going to be an equity raise and there was a problem with capital, they all fled all at once. You know, their deposits exploded during the pandemic boom for tech, over $200 billion. They put about $128 billion of that in relatively conservative investments, 5.7 years average duration, U.S. treasuries and government-backed mortgage securities. But then Powell went on a rampage, and he just started raising and raising and raising and raising. So believe it or not, it's kind of like you buy insurance from the insurance company, they set your house on fire, and then they say, what did you do? And that's part of what happened here and what they had to deal with. They had a $17 billion unrealized loss. If they held to maturity, they would come out at par, but they had unrealized loss. And with all the deposits fleeing, they had to sell some of those and actually make an unrealized loss realized. Then they wanted to raise another $2 billion of capital at the same time, and it just all fell apart. Last Wednesday, there was a rush to the exits.
I think we're following you on this. What investors are asking is this just SVB and I guess Signature Bank as well? And do other banks have the same problem or do that? Because we've heard from experts they don't have this problem. But then look what the market did today. It didn't really react in the way that perhaps some people thought it would because people are still very skeptical. Why?
Yeah, well, if the Fed's lending facility, it's called the Bank Term Funding Program. That's what they came out with over the weekend. If that was in place last week, Silicon Valley Bank would still be in business. And so potentially would Signature Bank as well, although they had some more crypto exposure and different things. But basically what happens with that is even if you have the unrealized loss, you can borrow from the Fed at the full value of your securities, what they would mature at because they're treasuries or they're government-backed securities, and they wouldn't have had to go out and raise capital even though the deposits were going out. Now, I do think the Fed is probably going to have to do one more thing, and rather than just implicitly guaranteeing deposits, potentially explicitly guaranteeing deposits, because right now there seems to be an incentive to move your deposits if you're a big business. Relatively smaller individuals and so on are staying in their banks and they're all staying put and there's no big deal. But bigger businesses, I think, are starting to move to the big four systemically important banks, and that's not really healthy for the banking system. So I do think we need to see some policy come down and say, we are going to have some level of backstop for unlimited deposits so that those deposits stay spread over the entire banking system versus just going into four banks.
Having gone through the financial crisis in 2008, a lot of people talked about compliance, risk management. Things are supposed to be so great, right? Look, I get it. You're saying rates went up. They've been going up for a year. They've had a year to get ready for whatever they were expecting to have happen. It didn't happen just yesterday. So blaming the Fed, yes, they're not necessarily to blame, but they're part of the cause. But they had a whole year to manage this risk. Where is this team?
Yeah, well, there's no question there were shortfalls, particularly at Silicon Valley Bank. And that's why you say when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. You know, they had an article that had the person who was helping clients was overseeing cases for the employee psychology. So not exactly a focused employee on risk management. And that's evident in the results.
All right, real quick, where do we go from here? People are talking about no rate hike. We had those inflations number that came in today. Markets seem to be okay with it. And then what are we supposed to do with our money? Are we supposed to panic or are we not supposed to panic?
No, there's no reason to panic. You'll have a few little aftershocks here. But moving forward, we've gone from expecting 100. The market has gone from expecting 125 basis points more of hikes to now we've got like an 80% chance, I think, as of the close of one more 25 basis point hike next week. And then that's done. And there are others saying, like Goldman, they should do no more hikes. I happen to agree with Goldman. We'll see what happens, but 25 basis points probably wouldn't be a reason to do it. But even so, what we know is now the pause has moved a lot closer.
Right.
And if that's the case, where do you want to be? You want to be in tech. Get some tech exposure. Some of these high quality businesses.
Give me real quick two names you would buy right now.
I'd buy Google. It's trading at 15.2 times 2024 earnings with 20% earnings growth. They're going to cut about 12,000 jobs. It's down 50%. I think that's a safe bet if you look out 1 to 2 years. Sure, some short-term slowing, but long-term, it's a quality franchise. They've got more AI than Microsoft could ever dream of. It's just not widely available yet. It will be. And then Bank of America, they're going to benefit from all those business deposits. They're trading at 8 times earnings, trading at a discount to book. So that's kind of interesting to us here as well.
Google and Bank of America. Thomas Hayes, as always, thank you very much.
And we're back. And finally, want to thank Mike Teague and Ann Berry for having me on public.com on Friday. That was right in the middle of it. I laid out some things that I said were going to happen as a result as it relates to the Fed. They seemed outlandish at the time. Now they're consensus. So you can check that out on your own time. Want to thank my good friend Lydia Moynihan, also David Proper and Bruce Golding, for quoting me in my favorite paper, the New York Post, about the banks. And the quote was about the cavalry coming to the rescue. I said, it only took 2 days of seeing regional banks crash for them to do the right thing. You can read that as well as, by the way, if you go to the New York Post, Google how to sign up for Lydia Moynihan's column, quote, On the Money. She does a lot of breaking stuff, and it's definitely worth getting that. It's free into your inbox and it's good stuff. David Barbustia from Reuters, want to thank him for including me in his article on Reuters. And what I said to him was what they're going to do with Credit Suisse. First, I said it was a pimple on the rear end of the global financial system. He said he couldn't quote that. I understand why, because I use a different word for rear end. And number two, I said, look, they're going to prop this thing up and walk it around like Weekend at Bernie's. And he kind of got that quote. He said, they're going to prop this thing up and walk it around like it's alive, but it will basically be a zombie bank that stay controlled. So listen, I know there are people from this, Credit Suisse that listen to this, and they're hardworking people, and many of them have extraordinarily high IQs and are very competent at what they do. But when I kind of communicate some cynicism, is this is a bank that for the last 10 years, number one, it's not a surprise, it's been in a downtrend since 2007. But number two, every single controversy, every single bad trade, every single mess on Wall Street, they've always been right in the middle. Now, that doesn't mean they can't turn around, because Deutsche Bank was exactly the same, by the way. They were the worst. And somehow their restructuring seems to actually be working, and their culture seems to have changed, and they might be a an interesting turnaround play. We don't own any Deutsche Bank, but I was surprised how well their turnaround is going. So I hope the same thing for Credit Suisse. Hopefully they'll get some new management that can turn things around and be good for all the employees. But there are plenty of talented people. They'll find their way at other places as well moving forward. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that and et cetera. Also want to thank Dave Briggs over at Yahoo Finance for quoting me in his article about TikTok. And then finally want to thank Shubham Kalia, Shubendu Deshmukh, and Yuraj Malik for including me in their article on Reuters. Also want to thank, acknowledge we had a zones or age group championship in UConn. I think I shared last week for my daughters, and Mimi, my eldest, swam a 5:58 in the 500 free, which was a personal best. Unbelievable. I mean, it was so exciting. I think that put her at 2 in the state, which is really exciting. And she was part of a relay team of 4 swimmers. She was the anchor and she dropped 3 seconds, got her personal best. They now hold the state record of all time for that event that was originally held by a relay team that have 2 current swimmers on the U.S. Olympic team. So they took their record, which is just amazing. And of course, Annabelle dropped time. So we're really excited. And they'll be at these major meet in Orlando. I don't know what it's called, but I think it's like zones or regionals or whatever. I don't know. They just tell me where to go. We go. We support them. They're doing incredibly great work, and I'm very proud of them. I don't have pictures. I'll have pictures next week. Moving right along. All right. Want to just kind of look at some of this data from last week as it relates to China, because, you know, the market's pessimistic on China, all the nonsense headlines, but the real issue is the dollar has been strong. That's why Chinese equities are down. The dollar will start to weaken when the Fed ends. When's the Fed going to end? Well, the Fed is going to end next week. They're either going to raise 25 bips and be very dovish about it and say that's it for some time, or they're not going to raise and say we're done. Either way, the dollar is going to start to resume its downtrend, and China and emerging markets are going to rip. And tech is already sniffing that out in the U.S. Because of rates, but now we'll get the emerging market bump on the dollar. So I'm very excited about that. But you can see just in the background, the data gets better and better. It won't matter until the dollar goes down, but it's better that it's happening, because when the dollar does go down, it's really going to be based on fundamentals. So it will be a sustainable long-term move. Money supply is up 12.9%, whereas ours is negative. New loans, they're juicing the economy, pushing new loans into the system, whereas our regional banks are contracting. Then we saw average hourly earnings last week come down. That's good for the Fed. It gives them cover, both on a monthly, month-on-month, and year-on-year basis. And the labor force participation rate hit a since the pandemic record high, which I've continued to say was the most critical factor, because you can put a lid on wages 2 ways. Number one, you can destroy the economy, which was plan A, which would destroy 2 million jobs. Or you can add new labor supply. And when people run out of money, they go back to work. When they go back to work, it creates more supply. Employers can be more choosy and they can pay less. And that's a good thing. And as a result, unemployment rate ticked up to 3.6, also giving the Fed cover. Quote of the week is from an interview with Carl Icahn. He's out on the scene again because he has a proxy fight against, I think, Illumina this time. But I caught this quote that was really interesting. He said, number 3, and this is kind of the theme of this podcast and how we've done things since day one, and Icahn is one of my heroes in terms of his performance and what he's been able to do. And what he says is, you have to buy things where the rest of the world is looking at you and thinking you're a little bit crazy. You're going against the trend, and a lot of times events are overblown on the good side and overblown on the bad side. So we like to buy things when they're overblown on the bad side, and we're going to cover a number of those stocks today because those are the ones we love. And then when everyone gets excited about them, that's when we lay them off down the road. So that's the context of the call today. Speaking of stocks that are down on the bad side, this was an article from Eric Savitz over at Barron's. He said, Dell could be tech's cheapest stock. The discount is unlikely to last. And he goes through this. And the basic premise is that what we've been talking about, which is that the pull forward for PC sales and servers, i.e. data centers, which topped out in 2020 and 2021, pulled forward a year or 2 years worth of demand, is now bottoming. Inventories are getting worked through. The demand is still there, and they're going to hockey stick. Now, we don't have any exposure in Dell. We may take a look at it, but we have expressed this in a different way through Intel, which is now finally getting a bid. And we're going to talk a little bit about Intel. And I got a little more latitude because our first off, I want to thank new people that are in. Woody, of course, thank you for joining, as well as the Dallas family now. They're all funded and live. And that gives us a little latitude to talk about some positions. But what I want to do here, number one, is obviously go to terms. I deal exclusively with accredited investors and qualified institutions. So I don't know your financial situation or your risk tolerance or anything. So talk to your financial advisor before you do anything. Number one. Number two, I'll talk about stocks. Some we may own, some we may not own. But I want to help deliver the concept, because what I've seen from the Ask Me Anything questions in recent months is people are really learning a lot, and they're bringing ideas to our attention that are already either on our radar or in our portfolio. So if we can be helpful and help you think for yourselves, that's going to be extremely valuable. Now, as far as how you size them, and as far as how you risk manage them, and as far as how you think about them in context of a portfolio, that's a whole 10-year course. But the key is learning how to do it. So we'll take a look at Dell, but this premise is the same as Intel. And if you remember the hint from a couple weeks ago when I was talking about the book Chip Wars and Andy Grove, who basically founded Silicon Valley, Pat Gelsinger was his protege. And Pat Gelsinger not only designed the framework or the foundation for all modern day, the U486, server chips, PC chips, he was the architect of that. But he was also mentored by Andy Grove, which is the greatest Silicon Valley executive to ever live. So, you know, Gelsinger basically was put in 2021 at the top, right before, you know, like every good CEO, right before the bottom fell out. So the guys, you know, basically had to find the coffee machine and turn around this huge company all at once. And it's taking a little time, but I would not bet against this guy. This is a pure jockey bet, because if we look at the financials, you're going to see there's nothing to really write home about right now. This is not an easy thing, but we do believe there's enough of a moat and enough of a demand rebound that even if their turnaround story about building the high quality chips doesn't go as they anticipate, which I think with Gelsinger it will, just on the core business, and that's why I highlight this Dell business, because it's a commodity business, the volumes are going to start to come back in a material way in the next 24 months, which means the market will start to discount it over the next 6 to 12 months, which is why we're positioned to take advantage of that. Now, you should keep in mind, our top three positions are still our top three positions, highest conviction, even in new accounts, Alibaba, biotech, and Cooper Standard. But we're talking about how we're filling out the whole bench here and some opportunities. Here's some more data on China on retail sales rebounded 3.5%. So it's starting to move in the right direction. Even residential property sales are starting to hockey stick up. And remember, we've only been open for about 10 weeks. So the game is just beginning. Now, the other thing you have to keep in mind is when fundamentals make zero sense, you have to have some concept of technicals, and I don't give much weight to the technical analysis, but I do appreciate patterns, and it helps me kind of just quantify mentally how to get through periods until the fundamentals are recognized by the market, and then it takes off. So the first one I have here is the XBI Equal Weighted Biotech ETF, and we've talked about this analog many times about how biotech took off, and then they started the tightening cycle, and from 2016 to 2018, it collapsed over 50%, and then it went on to make new highs over the next 2 years. And we basically followed that model, okay? So we collapsed in 2021 to 2022. We bottomed in May of 2022. And just like we had this initial rally and then a consolidation in 2016, you can see here, even just looking at a simple indicator, and you know, these are not, it doesn't mean it's going to repeat in any way, but it just speaks to a little bit about the psychology and a little bit about what to expect. So we've had this monster move off the May lows, then we consolidated, and you get this little pullback here and this little pullback here, and that's to shake out all the late money that didn't want it in May, bought up when it was up 50% in December, and then they got to get shaken out, probably with like a 50% retracement, you know, of the move, which would be about 15 points, which I think we did. And then you know, you consolidate for a few months, and that's when you make the next move back up to, you know, whether we make new highs or we revert back to a double here is immaterial. The key is the normal pattern of no one believes it, the psychological pattern, then it rips up, everyone believes it when they missed it, they get FOMO, and that's when you get ripped, you rip their faces off for 3 months to take them out. They no longer believe because they missed it here, they bought at the top, they lost again. And then once they no longer believe, then it's just a straight up parabolic move. And it's the same thing, even if you look at the Hang Seng, the Hong Kong Shanghai Index, I was looking at some of these bottoms over the years, and it's the exact same thing every time. And the one that kind of really rings a bell is this 1998 scenario where you had this straight shoot up off the bottom. No one believed it right up to the consolidation when it was crashing. It pulled back, not for 1 month, not for 2 months, for 3 months. So we're on month two. Maybe we get another month of crap. It's possible. But then what happened afterwards? It went straight up and let no one in again, and went on to make new highs. So even in 2016, you had a similar scenario. Very quick up, pulling back for a few months, 3-4 months, and then straight up after no one believes until they... Until they reach a new high. BABA is doing the exact same thing. We've covered that ad infinitum. And the only reason I'm wasting any time on technical analysis here is when the fundamentals don't make sense, just to keep your head in the game, because you think that the price movement has something to do with the underlying business. And what I'm laying out is you got to buy it when people think you're crazy. Why do they think you're crazy? Because they're buying it on the basis of price. And if you're doing your work, you're buying it on the basis of intrinsic value and business value for the long term. And that's how you're going to make the money. And when they're chasing up because they're just looking at price and don't understand value, you'll be happy to lay it off to those people at the next top. So, you know, if you look here at the big low in 2015, they had this rally up. Then the crash down, rally up, crash down, and then they made a new high, chased everyone in, and boom, they crashed it back for 1, 2, 3, or 4 months, just like the Hang Seng. And then what was the next move? It was absolutely parabolic from 80 to 211 within less than 6 or 12 months here. Let's see, from December 2016 to November 2017. So within a year, you had your big parabolic move about 110 points. And the similar thing in 2018. The difference here is the business value is so much greater today than it was at either 211 or 319 in the past. So I think that over the next 3 to 5 years, we can go on to make new highs. But same type of thing in 2018 and 19. You had your low, you had your shakeout, then you start to move up, everyone buys in, they get all excited, and then you rip their face off for 3 or 4 months before your final big parabolic move. In this case, it was from 180 to 319, so that was 140 points, and that happened in about May to September, so May of 2020 to November of 2020. Is that right? My goodness. 6 months. Wow. 140 points in 6 months. So go ahead and keep selling me your Alibaba. I'm putting it in new accounts like it's going out of style, and happy to help out. Same thing if you look at the S&P 500, right? So you had this ugly low and then a lower low, and then you come out of it and it acts like absolute dog meat to fake everyone out. You get these kind of rollovers, and then these fake outs like you see here. This is basically what we're in right here. This absolute dog you know what, where it's just saying this is not real. We're going back to new lows, like everyone was saying. This is that 2008 again. By the way, they were saying this exact same thing in 2011. It's 2008 again. What's that called? It's called recency bias. And then what happens? It's going to rip their faces off, and we're going to go back up to, we're going to go back up to new highs. That's going to be maximum effery in the next 12 months is when we hit new highs, and all these idiots that were saying we're going to new lows, or we're going 20% below the lows, or the triple break putt people are going to say, what happened? What happened was we discounted the problems of 2023 in 2022, just like we do every time, 6 to 12 months beforehand. And now we're going to discount the 2024 recovery in 2023. So keep an open mind. Try to stay calm in the storm. For those of you who are on vacation this week, God bless you. Nothing happened this week. Don't worry, you didn't miss a thing. And by the way, price is about the same as where it was last week after all that nonsense. So the only advantage of the last few days is that we had a chance to put some stuff on, which was exciting. All right, article of the week, the deja vu, not all over again. Like Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again. Well, it's this time it's not all over again. Stock market and sentiment results. Recency bias or availability bias is a cognitive error identified in behavioral economics whereby people incorrectly believe that recent events will occur again soon. This tendency is irrational as it obscures the true or objective probabilities of events occurring, leading people to make poor decisions. When the quote news came overnight that Credit Suisse was having difficulty, my initial reaction was, what else is new? Anyone who's not aware that Credit Suisse was challenged for some time must be sleeping under a rock. Every single Wall Street crisis, bad trade, or scandal in the past decade has always included this bank front and center in the middle of the mess. Again, let me clarify. Deutsche Bank also shared this notoriety. They've seemed to have turned their ship around. And hopefully Credit Suisse can do the same. I know a lot of really high quality people there. I'm not speaking to the people. I'm just speaking generally to what's been happening. Now, they needed some capital from their largest investor, the Saudi National Bank. They said no mas. So the Swiss bank will have to step in. They actually did step in this morning to provide the liquidity and backstop the bank in coming days. That was pretty obvious, and that's how it played out. Now, for all the recency bias of people running around talking about, quote, counterparty risk, and this is another 2008, you know, the big difference here, and I said in one of the media appearances, is that you don't have postal workers owning five properties that can't afford them when their interest-only loans come due. You know, these banks largely hold government bonds, which will get back to par. They just got smoked because the Fed forced them out on the risk curve, as I said with Charles, by buying bonds and forcing them to reach for yield. And the only way they could do it is going out further on the curve. In the case of SVB, they were only 5.7-year duration. They weren't cowboys. They just didn't know how to manage it when the tide changed. So first they had to reach, then you had this parabolic hiking rate, maniacal. I want to be Paul Volcker, this and that. No context or feel or finesse around the market similar to what happened in December 2018. And it put the bond portfolios upside down. So the key difference that we're seeing now is between now and 2008 is that everyone now understands what happened as a result of letting Lehman go. And for those of you who don't know the story, they wanted to punish Dick Fuld, who was the CEO of Lehman, for not stepping up to help during the long-term capital management crisis in 1998. He was the only bank that wouldn't pitch in to bail them out. So they said, this is our time to get them back. The problem with that was they shot themselves in the foot, and the bailout cost $800 billion because they wanted to show Dick Fuld a lesson. And it took the economy basically 10 years to recover. Dick Fuld, on the other hand, as far as I know, he's doing just fine. I'm sure he's playing a lot of golf. He walked away with some money. And as a result of this, we know that global central banks will step in quickly and forcefully in a coordinated manner as needed to maintain stability, just like they did overnight. And they can't afford not to with the size of the balance sheets and the amount of debt to GDP. Their only game is going to be to inflate this away. Whether they know it or not, that's the only game plan. It's the only one that's ever worked. It's what we did post-World War II. If there's any risk manager that's taken on major counterparty risk with Credit Suisse, they should be looking for another career. To put it in perspective, Credit Suisse is now an $8 billion bank. This compares to $377 billion for JP Morgan, $227 billion for Bank of America. This is not enterprise value. This is just market cap, easy numbers. Goldman Sachs at $100 billion. Credit Suisse is... All right, I'm not going to say that again. I've made my point. So the Swiss National Bank will prop it up, ring fence it, and move on. As for the regional banking quote-unquote crisis in the U.S., Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, you literally have a situation where management was more focused on providing safe spaces and pronouns for their employees than managing risk and protecting the shareholders. You can click on these articles from my favorite newspaper, the New York Post, favorite business paper, Barron's. Unfortunately, the pronouns have now turned into adjectives. Those adjectives are unemployed and looking for work as it relates to the employees. And the nouns are donut hole and goose egg as it relates to owners and investors. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all for pronouns and safe spaces if the employees want them. But not when the programs are run by the same employee that's supposed to risk manage the portfolio, which if you read the article, you'll find out who was their part-time risk manager. Or in the case of SBNY, the CEO was too busy giving classes on assigning the correct pronouns, zur and all these kind of pronouns that I didn't even know exist. So rather than focusing on the business at hand. So that stuff needs to be delegated to human resources, not people that have major responsibilities for keeping the bank going and managing the risk. And in this case, these two isolated cases, they didn't get the memo. Now, the good thing that came out of this is there is this new facility that Charles was talking about on his show has up to $2 trillion of liquidity. As of last week, there was about $600 billion of unrealized losses across the regional portfolios, but they're all government securities, so they will mature. They have the government full faith and credit of the U.S. government, which means if this bank lending facility had been around last week, we would have zero bankruptcies and zero takeovers. So this will solve a lot of problems because they did. It's not like they were cowboys buying CMBS and RMBS in 2007. They're buying government bonds. They're basically doing what the government told them to do. It's just that they got underwater when the Fed got overly aggressive without any willingness to wait for the lagged effect of their actions. And now that they can borrow from this, this, as far as I know, I heard on the way home back from the city that about $300 billion has been drawn. Now, that is basically an increase in the Fed's balance sheet. So within 48 hours, we've gone from quantitative tightening within a week, super quantitative tightening to expecting, you know, another 125 basis points of hikes to basically back to quantitative easing. This adds, so far, $300 billion of liquidity into the system, maybe up to $2 trillion. It's the right thing to do. But as I've been saying for many, many months, that over-tightening was going to cost them way more than responsibly tightening. And the opportunity of what to do was they should have stopped raising rates at 3.5%, 3 or 3.5, and used the opportunity to wind down the balance sheet. If you want to withdraw liquidity, there's two ways. You can hike rates, which destroyed the housing market, which is not necessary at a time when we have a housing shortage and 80 million millennials looking to buy houses and they're priced out because the Fed can't think three moves ahead. Rather, what they could have done to drain liquidity, keep rates low, and take down that balance sheet so we have some bullets for the next crisis. Instead, we're at the end of a tightening cycle and we still have a balance sheet of $8.3 trillion. They could have had a $6 trillion balance sheet and had rates at 3.5% and achieved the same results and had inflation down to 6% on its way down to 3%. And it'll run 3-5% for the next few years, and that'll help us bring debt to GDP down to a normalized level of 60% like we did post-World War II. So there's plenty of blame to go around, as I covered in my media appearances this week. The Fed acted like an insurance company that sells you a homeowner's policy, burns your house down, and then asks you what you were thinking when they have to pay you out. That's basically what happened over the last week. There's been no basic understanding of the lag effect of maniacal tightening until something broke, and now they have to fix it. As I said months ago, over-tightening would become more inflationary than not tightening enough, as the interest cost to service the national debt and the bailout cost to fix things after they break them will far exceed the cost of running inflation. above trend for a few years, as we did the last time we had debt to GDP at 120%, which was post-World War II, running it above inflation. We brought it down to 63% in a handful of years. Now, just think about the numbers today. A few hundred billion already drawn. They wouldn't have had to do that if they paused 100 basis points ago and just drained liquidity through the balance sheet. It would have been better, but they just, you know, anyway, they're fighting the last war with the, you know, last war's artillery. Imagine if we were trying to fight, a foreign enemy with muskets and, cannonballs. I mean, that's basically what they were doing with going maniacal with the 1982 policy in a set of circumstances that's completely different in 2023, with debt to GDP at 120 versus 33, and they're fighting with bayonets and cannonballs versus heat-seeking missiles and submarines and aircraft carriers and all the good things that we have today. So anyway, it is what it is. Now they'll have to pay for it, and now they're back to quantitative easing before they even expect. So the number one thing you need to understand is this. If the bank term funding program, which was put in place over the weekend, existed last Wednesday, both SVB and SBNY would likely still be in business. They would have been able to borrow against the par value of their government security bond portfolios to meet any short-term funding needs versus spooking the capital markets with an equity raise. Here were my media takes. Okay, so we covered all that. You can watch those. Canada has paused hiking rates. Indonesia has paused hiking rates, and so has Malaysia. No bank failures in those countries. Expectations, and then we'll have to do bailouts either. Hundreds of billions of dollars worth of bailouts. Expectations for the Fed have gone from 125 basis points more of hikes just a week ago to between 0 to 25 basis points before pausing next week. Markets are now also pricing in a cut or more before the end of the year. After last week's political pressure from Senator Warren and Congresswoman Presley, it is becoming more and more apparent that if Chair Powell does not pause soon, he will be among the 2 million job losses potentially coming as a result of his aggressive tightening cycle. As I've said for a year, he could have managed the liquidity withdrawal more effectively from unwinding the balance sheet more aggressively as opposed to mindlessly hiking rates until something broke. Well, he finally broke something last week and will now have to clean up his mess. Progress on the balance sheet has been minimal, complete missed opportunity. He could have taken this down to here and kept rates at 3.5 and not screwed all the 30-year-olds who are starting their families and can't afford houses now because he destroyed the market. Powell has an opportunity to salvage himself next week by pausing, or worst case, one last hike and then a pause to quote-unquote save face. Whenever you live to play defense in life, you wind up with the outcome you most hope to avoid. He desperately wanted to be Volcker instead of Arthur Burns. Arthur Burns may wind up smelling like a rose after the debacle of 2018 autopilot, which was his first mess, followed up by never-ending bond purchases after inflation was evident, followed by mindless, unrelenting rate hikes until something broke. That's his latest. Three strikes in any other game, you're out. The good news is he can now pause and save face. Maybe, just maybe, get a softish landing if he relents in time, as he did after the December 2018 disaster. Thank God for Steven Mnuchin, who saved us from a complete catastrophe then. And Steven Mnuchin, who, by the way, I think is the smartest government servant we've ever had, who saved us from a Great Depression during the middle of the pandemic. He deserves 100% of the credit in both of those instances. The data and recent events, and it's sad that we no longer have him working in the government. The data and recent events now give the Fed plenty of cover. Look at PPI completely rolling over, CPI completely rolling over, inflation expectations completely rolling over. You don't need a magnifying glass to understand which way inflation is headed, and that is before the impact of the year-on-year lease declines kick in coming months. On the plus side, Atlanta GDP estimates are now showing Q1 GDP still above 3%, and earnings estimates have slowly started ticking up. Here's Ryan Dietrich with the seasonality. Starts mid-month, weak in the first half of the month, strong in the second half. Here's RBC, my friend, thanks to my buddy over there who sends these over to me. This is monthly seasonality, starts to tick up in March. April is the strongest month. And then finally, this is something that I alluded to last week. S&P components with positive 3-month percent change in forward earnings inflected from 47% to 60.4%. What does that mean? Earnings estimates are starting to turn up and no one is paying attention to it. The 2024 recovery is on its way. As a matter of fact, I listened to an investor presentation this morning from 3M, And you should take a listen about what they were talking about in terms of foreign expectations, etc., and China. Where we are in the secular trend, putting things in perspective, this is from Fidelity. By the way, this is also, this was from Yardeni, the earnings via Seth Golden. This is from Fidelity. So you can see here, this is very interesting. Secular bear, secular bull, secular bear, secular bull. This goes back to 1871. You can see the bears are much shorter than the bulls. And the bulls, you know, in the 1800s, you had this bull, once you got above the blue line, it went from 1881 to basically 1914. So you had basically, you know, 34-year secular bull. And then in 1950s, you had basically a 20-year secular bull. Then in the 1980s, you had another basically 20-year secular bull. And here we just got above the blue line, it looks like, in about 2013. So we've been gone for 10. That would be the shortest secular bull that we've ever had. And that's been our case, that this thing's going to go well into 2030, maybe the early 2030s before our demographics stall out. Remember, at the end of last year, we were telling everyone, was pitching energy, industrials, materials. We were saying that trade's done. You want to be in communication services and tech. Well, this has been the biggest outperformer since, and we're going to get the tailwind from emerging markets as the Fed gets out of the way. As far as the auto update, Cooper Standard got caught in the headwinds of all these banks and rates and deleveraging and weak hands, etc. But if you continue to stick to the facts, the thesis is well intact, and you can listen to Phil LeBeau. As a matter of fact, we'll play that right now.
So Jonas today, quote, auto investors should prepare for light vehicle supply to rise and financial institution willingness to lend to fall at the same time. So give me your thoughts on that first, because Jonas is kind of the guy.
Well, he's right on both of those. Well, I shouldn't say he's right on both. He's right on the first part. The supply is rising. That is clear. The automakers are making more new vehicles. We will see that increase throughout the year as they've gone past the chip and the component supply issues. At the same time, what he alludes to in this note is what we're seeing here with Silicon Valley Bank and the other issues surrounding the banking sector, does that make everybody a little more hesitant to write somebody an auto loan?
Sure.
So
one can only assume that the answer to that question is yes.
That would imply that we are going to see a real dramatic increase in inventory at the dealer lot. Right now, the day supply, it's about 40 days supply, according to J.D. Power. So if it's a normal market, it should be closer to 60 to 7 days supply. Do I think we get back to 60, 70 days supply this summer? I don't think we get there this summer. But maybe by the end of the year, you start to see it get there. That's what he's talking about, which then raises the question, do we start to see the return of incentives and deals in order? And you're already starting to see this with the local ads. Look around the country and you will see local ads saying special financing. Those days might be coming back.
Okay, so.
And then we'll also play Mary Barra right now.
Mary, we just had Jim LeCamp of Morgan Stanley on, and he was talking about how he pretty much expects that you would possibly see lenders, people who write everything from mortgage to auto loans, start to freeze up because of what happened over the weekend with the bank crisis that appears to, at least at the moment, be ended because of all the regulators diving in. Are you seeing anything at all about auto loans and auto lending that indicates to you there's a slight slowdown?
Well, I think what's important for General Motors is we have General Motors Finance.
Right.
And so when the banks, you know, make a decision like that with our, because we have a wholly owned captive finance company, we're able to still support the customer. And in fact, you know, GM Financial, we bought it after the last financial crisis, but they actually made money through the entire, Great Recession. So I think with that, we're going to be in good shape to serve the customer.
Okay, so you don't expect to tighten any regulations of your own over at GM Financial?
Well, again, they run a great business where they really know how to manage risk, and so I have complete faith in that team.
Mary Barra, great to see.
So you can get a sense of production and captive finance and incentives coming down the pike, which has been our thesis since day one. Everyone's saying, well, banks won't lend on cars. Banks won't lend on used cars. New cars is going to be Incentive City, and the captive financing from the OEMs that can offer 0%, 1%, 2% financing in a 6, 7, 8% market. And that's why new cars are going to sell like crazy. And that's and the other reason is because the average car is 13.1 years and they're just falling apart. So that's that. Now, China update. It all comes down to the U.S. dollar when the Fed pauses, which will now be much sooner than expected, i.e. next week. It's either 25 in pause or 0 in pause. The dollar resumes its downtrend. Emerging markets in China will fly once again. And here is the dollar relative to the Baba. As the dollar went up, Baba crashed. As the dollar stopped going up, Baba ripped off the bottom. Then the dollar had a counter trend bounce. Baba did that shakeout for the weak hands that bought up here. And now the dollar will resume its downtrend after the end of next week. And we expect emerging markets in China to start to rip once again and sustain because the fundamentals continue to get better in the background. But no one pays attention to that because they just get hypnotized by price rather than value. Price is what you pay. Value is what you get. And it, and to make big money in this business, you got to understand the value. Otherwise, you'll get shaken out every time silly things like this happen. Our next podcast will be going through a number. That's what we're doing right now. Sentiment completely washed out. Retail investors are at 19.2% bullish, 48% bearish. That's levels that you want to be a buyer, not a seller. Same thing with fear and greed got washed out, etc. So earnings, this is it. No one wants to look at this because it's not a fancy little squiggly line. But let's just take a look at the top 30 weights of retail earnings posted by George. In the last 60 days, the cumulative earnings power of these top 30 weights in the retail sector ETF was revised down by 1.2%. For 2024, it was revised up by 1.28%. What do you think the market is going to start to discount? The market discounted this situation last year. It's going to start to discount this situation this year. Take a look at transports. Everyone's so pessimistic on the economy. Well, even for this year, they were revised up, the top 30 weights, by 68 basis points in the last 60 days. But for 2024, they were revised up 5.77%. You wouldn't know it from listening to the Nouriel Roubinis of the world saying that we're going to go back to hell, or the Robert Kiyosaki saying this is just the beginning of the next Great Depression, which they've both been saying for the last 15 years of the bull market since the Great Financial Crisis. But you know, you have to be burdened by the facts is all I can tell you. And, you know, everyone has their specialties. I'm sure Roubini is a fantastic economics professor and a great guy. And I'm sure Robert Kiyosaki has made a ton of money in real estate. But I don't want to listen to him for information about the stock market. If I had any interest in gold, I might listen to him about that. He seems to know a lot about gold, seems to know a ton about real estate. Very successful guy. But those are the areas that I would look to take advice from them. As a matter of fact, I was saying to someone the other day, like, hey, I'm a pretty good hockey player, but you know, you shouldn't put me on a basketball court and just expect that I'm going to be good because I know how to play hockey. And I think that we far too often make the same mistake, is we think if someone's good at one thing, they're good at everything. And I think that the greatest advantage that I've developed over the years is I know I'm not good at most things, and I accept that. But the few things that I am good at, I just spend all my time doing. So it works. So that's that. Some more economic data from this week. We went through the inflation numbers. We went through the Chinese retail sales, et cetera. And I think that's the core thing. So let's get down to some earnings. I mean, we showed you last week, basically, they're just starting to tick up here a little bit. Looking at the FactSet stuff. Okay. I want to just get to some AMA questions here. Let's see if I can get to that or not. There it is. Oh, all right. So now it rolled back down a little bit, but that's not consistent with Yardeni's. But look, bottom line is it's been at 250 and it stayed there. I think these are going to start to go up. And how do we know? Because we're looking under the surface here. And if you look at transports, which is a key indicator, getting these upward revisions, that's a good start. So we'll see how this evolves over the next few weeks and keep a close eye on it. Okay, so let's do the Ask Me Anything questions. And if we have time, we'll do more of the some of the companies we covered with Charles today. Okay, this is from Drew. Drew asks, great to see everything going from strength to strength to you over time. You deserve it more for what you... Okay, Chip War was a fascinating read. Appreciate your recommendation. Oh, this was from a couple of weeks ago, actually. We couldn't talk about Intel because we were building up, starting to build in some accounts and the position, and now we've completed in most accounts as of, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday's weakness. I was struck by... Chip War was a really fascinating read. Appreciate your recommendation. So this guy figured it out. He reverse engineered it. Drew Byrne, smart guy. I was struck by how Intel really dropped the ball at a crossroads decades ago and then wondered, due to the CHIPS Act, U.S. government funding, what I've read in Chip War about Intel being placed with manufacturing infrastructure as opposed to design, if Intel may have the potential for a revival, and whether or not whether the other group, including NVIDIA, AMD, Micron, may be a better place to benefit. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Feel free to ignore for a future video cast if too early to discuss. Just want to ask while fresh in my mind after reading the book. Thanks as always, Drew. So great question. Let's take a look at it because this one's not obvious, but sometimes you get through cycles long enough and you kind of, you know, you start to get an instinct for what businesses are indestructible and what the difference between businesses that have temporary impairments and permanent impairments. And Intel, in our view, is very cyclical. I'm not even placing any real value on Pat Gelsinger's dream where he's going to make these high-end chips and he's going to have these fabs and all that stuff. All that, for me, is whipped cream. What I can see is basically... the inventory cycle has bottomed, and over the next 6 to 12 months, it's going to start to turn. No one realizes it, and what you're going to see, as a matter of fact, Susquehanna today called the bottom, which was kind of interesting. The note, if anyone works for Susquehanna, please send me the note. I heard about it today. I didn't have time to look for it. So just on normalized PC and server and cloud demand, I think this thing can revert back up to, you know, 55-60 range. And from 25 basis, you know, you don't need much. If you've got, you know, 80% stock and then you've got some exposure via options, you know, you can really make a nice return and a nice IRR over the next few years. And if Gelsinger's plan comes to bear, then you've got a business that could be, you know, $70 to $90 and really make a mint. In the meantime, it's a great place to park money. You get a little dividend, but you can see what happened here. And what's clear, leave away all the headlines. If you remember, 2020 was their peak, right? You had all the pull forward of demand while everyone was locked in their house. They had $8.12 of cash flow per share. They had $5.31 of earnings per share. And that was that. And 2019 wasn't a pull forward. So what does normalized commodity business look like? That's not high-end, not high-tech, not their own fab, not competing with NVIDIA in design, et cetera, which they're going to start to if Gelsinger is right. And Gelsinger is the only guy that I would bet on being able to do it for Intel. But 724 and 489. So, you know, 489 of earnings normalized, non-pull forward at, you know, average. And once they start growing again, they're not going to trade at 12 times, which would be a $50 stock. They're going to start to trade back to 15 plus once they can show growth and start to promote the promise of the future. Remember, despondency reverts to euphoria over time. They'll start to buy the story and they'll start to assign a ridiculous multiple. And that's how you can take the same $5 of normalized earnings with a new story with the 20 multiple. It gets you to an $80 or $100 stock. Versus a $45 or $50 stock if everyone's still pessimistic, but the cycle turns. So, you know, like in poker, which I've got to go to in about an hour, there are many outs. And this one, I think, have enough outs. But you can look at the stock price from 60 down to 30 or 25. That's very simple. Well, you know, they cut their earnings in half. They cut their cash flow in half. It should be trading down here. So you're making a bet that the... inventory cycle is cyclical. We're at or near a bottom, and that's why we're involved. And we could be wrong, and it could be the next IBM. But I'm betting on the jockey here, and this one is little less obvious than some of the others because you have to have a little faith versus just deal exclusively in the numbers, and it's sized proportionately. This is not our top three weights or one of our highest conviction ideas. This is a part of the portfolio that we think can meet the IRR expectations that we have over the next 3 years, and this fits in the bucket. So we like it, and we want exposure to that group, and that group's been starting to be on a tear, and people are starting to see what we see. So that's a good thing. Moving right along, from Paul Falcone, hope all is well. I was looking around for opportunities this morning and came across SWK, Stanley Black & Decker, beaten down, pretty good, leader in the tool space. Margins have dropped pretty hard in recent quarters. Curious for your thoughts. Have a good one. So we like this one. By the way, we're not going to disclose whether we own it or we don't own it, but this one is... we like what he's talking about here. Now, this is a very similar situation. This thing traded up to... let's see here. SWK. So this traded up to $213. It dropped down to $70. It's now at $80. And you can see, again, you know, we want to base our decision on fundamental understanding the intrinsic business value. But you can see over time that this happens. They go through cycles like 2009 and 2003 recession, where they drop 66%, okay, from 32 down to 13, from 44 down to 16, from 157 down to 65, and this time from 213 down to 70 or 80, and then they recover. Why do they recover? It's apparent that they have some level of moat in their brand, in their quality, in what they do. They have probably operate in an oligopoly or a duopoly of some sort, certainly on a branded basis. And they recover over time. And I think that's a reasonable bet just looking at it. But let's be burdened with some of the facts and kind of walk through this here. So trying to just do these simply here in the interest of time, because a lot more goes into it. But you can see, why is the stock down 66%? Well, that's pretty simple. You had some pull forward during the pandemic. You got up to $12 of cash flow per share, $10 of earnings per share. And now you've cut both of those in half. And what's happened to the stock? It's more than cut in half because things overshoot on the upside. They overshoot on the downside. And that's the story. So what you have to make a determination is even though margins have contracted, sales have continued to climb, and they're expected to recover. So when you look at this, companies going through massive cost reduction, and they're going through a restructuring, they're cutting costs out of it. And then what will happen is the demand will come back. So there'll be a leaner, this is a consistent thing. It's the same thing that Gelsinger's doing, the same thing that Google's doing, the same thing that Amazon's doing, the same thing that PayPal is doing. The sales declined because they had a pull forward. There was some cyclical part of their business. They cut all the costs at the bottom. And then when the cycle starts to recover, and they get carried away, their margins are much higher because they cut all the people at the downtrend. And I think that's similar with Stanley Black & Decker. You got to dig a little longer, dig a little deeper, listen to some of their calls, the investor presentations, etc. Get some comfort into why do they revert back to the mean over time, okay? Why would they recover as they have in the past on the basis of the pull forward, on the basis of the margin compression, on the basis of the supply chain. I mean, we're in such a unique opportunity right now that the pandemic created such abnormal temporary impairments for such high quality businesses that you'll never get opportunities like this for many of these businesses moving forward. And as you can see, this business was a consistent double digit compounder for almost a decade before this recent thing. So this is a management that has a consistent, you know, mid-teens return on equity, low double digits return on capital, quality business, and now you can pick it up for, you know, 16 times trough earnings, and then when you get back to $9-$10 a share, this multiple will go back up to its mean is about 15 times. If you get growth back and pull forward, you probably get back up to 18 times 10. You're back to 180 up from 80, and it may take, you know, 3 years, it may take 4 years, but historically, this thing tends to come out of recessions pretty abruptly and pretty quickly, as it did in 2003. And by the way, this story is very similar to Cooper Standard, so It's got a special place in my heart. So I think good thinking on that one, Paul. We like it. Obviously, a lot more work to do there, but we want to get through a few here. So I just want to give you a little bit of a response so you can start your process. Bob Johnson, in light of the SVB collapse, more folks are speaking out more firmly that the S&P will not only retest 3,500 from October 2022, but those calling for sub-3,300 are getting louder as well. These triple break putt guys are still in the sand trap. Now they want to move into the water hazard. Also, two pieces of data points. Your podcast sits atop my hedge fund and macroeconomic podcasts. I've been constantly sharing them with my friends. Thank you for sharing it with your friends. My portfolio is up 38% year to date thanks to your content. Thanks very much, Bob. I appreciate that. Glad to hear it. But I'm sure you had a lot to do that with that as well. So good stuff. Okay. Xavier Noguera. Ask me anything question. Hi, Thomas. First time caller. Long time listener, first time caller. Hoping to hear your thoughts on Western Union at these prices, less than $12 a share. Stock is trading single digit PE, nearly single digit price to free cash flow. Additionally, pays a healthy 8% dividend. That's less than 60% of their free cash flow. Have a core challenge of migrating customers to digital and losing chunks of earnings by ending service in Russia and Belarus. Digital switch numbers appear strong in the headwinds. Price laps seem overdone. You know, I looked at this one a while back, and I just couldn't get comfortable with it. Let me take a look real quick. I think you're probably right, but I just couldn't get there because, you know, and it's the same kind of trouble that I'm facing, you know, even looking at the payment processors. But I think PayPal's got a big of enough moat that as much as it's a crowded space and they might have margin contraction, the inflation's going to help them on ticket size. And, you know, with Venmo and everything else, I don't want to bet against it. It's like all the bad news about management, missing estimates, change in management, but the business is still performing. We'll look at PayPal in just a second so you can get an idea. But Western Union, let's have a look-see-loo. See if I can get any comfort here. I don't know. My gut with Western Union is it's kind of like a declining business, and it might not be a temporary impairment. But I could be wrong. So let's see if there's any signs of hope in this thing. Consistently declining revenue. Year after, 2021 was decent, and it's just kind of falling off. EBIT's been falling. Let's see. Earnings. Steady state. Let's take a look about cash flow. Cash flows halved in the last handful of years. This looks like a secular decliner to me, so I'm generally going to avoid at any price. Not because it won't work. I mean, this thing is beat down. You know, maybe in the high single digits, you'll get a huge bounce up to 15 and call it a day if you want to be a trader. I'd just go in my too hard pile. I don't really have any sense of what this business is going to look like in coming years. I mean, it's been a compounder. Let's see here. I think your thought process is right. You know, sometimes just through long time of experience, you just have a gut for things. And you can't quantify gut, but I usually only use gut on the downside, things to omit. And I'll never worry about errors of omission. I will worry about errors of commission. So if I miss this, I won't lose sleep over it. If this thing went to $50 overnight, I would, like, it wouldn't faze me whatsoever. I think it warrants more work. So, Xavier, I'm going to pass for myself, but I think if you got on, you know, a couple years worth of conference calls and read the annual report for the last couple years and did a few channel checks, this might be worth a punt in the high single digits. You also got to get a sense of their balance sheet just to make sure that there's no ticking time bomb on them going BK. which I don't think there is. So they got $1.2 billion of cash. They've got $2.6 billion of debt. So, no, not the end of the world. I think this is a medium quality business at best. It's trading at the same level as 2004. The business has kind of been in secular decline. It's not the kind of thing that I want. By the way, this is what distinguishes, you know, when I say I have a value tilt, this is the type of stuff value investors love. This is the type of stuff I would never touch. I like quality businesses that compound capital that you could call value because at the times in the cycle I'm buying them, they're at value offerings in terms of the valuation at which they're trading, but they're still secular growers and they're quality businesses with some level of moat for the most part. We do turnarounds in special situations like Intel, like Cooper Standard, etc. But most of the businesses we're in, we're just buying them when they're out of favor, but they're still quality compounders over time. So Arthur Lair, appreciate your continued great work. After the last few crazy days, are there any bank stocks that you're getting interested in? How do you evaluate bank stocks? Any metrics you look at? This one, I'm not chasing the regionals, by the way. I'm putting those in my too hard box because there's just too many different things that could happen. And I'm not convinced until they backstop the deposits that the regionals are not going to have continued outflows. Because this was not a thought before last week. But because they broke things and they opened the kimono and showed who was swimming naked, now no one knows who's swimming naked. So if you have deposits over $1 million or over a quarter of $1 million, you know, for a business account or a personal account, you know, you're probably going to migrate to Bank of America, Citi, JP Morgan. And we think the best value here is Bank of America, which we covered with Charles, because it's trading at a discount to book. It's trading at 8x forward. It's better managed. You know, Wells Fargo was an incredible trade for us in 2020, but they've made some changes, and I'm not impressed with how the business has been run, and I'm really disappointed that this year, in recent weeks or months, right at the bottom, they decided that they were going to pare back their involvement in the mortgage business. Like, how stupid can you get to shave down your core bread and butter for three decades at the bottom of the cycle? I mean, rates are now going down. The game is going to be back on, and they cut bait at the exact wrong time. It reminds me of GE buying energy companies at the top in 2014, selling financial services at the bottom in 2009. You just can't make more wrong-minded moves. And then you got a CEO who, you know, wants to run a West Coast business from New York City. It just, you know, it's I'm not as enamored. I mean, I like Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo will be fine, and it'll probably trade with Bank of America. But Moynihan, man, that guy was dealt a dog you know what hand, and he turned it into, you know, S into Shinola, as we say. And the guy is just super high quality. The valuations are similar to Wells, so why do I want Wells with the guy that just has a, you know, again, cultural issues? They're probably both the same trade, but I really am angry about the fact that they shaved back their mortgage business in the hole. Any CEO that sells in the hole, they go on my don't touch list. And Moynihan is probably ramping up, getting ready for the next cycle, and that's the kind of guy I want to deal with. And by the way, they picked up $15 billion in deposits over the weekend while the Fed was fumbling about how to do it, and they still haven't finished the job. Maybe they'll get away with it, but the regional banks are going to, they're not going to be in good shape until the deposits are backstop. You're going to just see more and more deposits go to the big. So they basically created more systemic risk. The big four are going to get bigger until they backstop those regionals. And for those who say, oh, it'll die down and people will forget, that's partially true for all the retail depositors. But businesses, without that explicit guarantee, they're all going to move out of the regionals. And that's a sad thing for the country, because they don't know how to manage the policy properly. So hopefully they'll come up with some sensible fix, maybe raising the limits to a few million dollars for commercial accounts or something like that. But, you know, this would have never become an issue if they hadn't kept raising mindlessly until something broke. But they did what they always do, and that's a sad thing. Unless, you know, so that's that. Okay, moving right along. Adam Golparvar, equity analyst managing portfolio. Okay, all right. We'll get on there. That was a personal question. Drew, here we go. Another one from Drew. Hi, Tom. Appreciate your stellar content every week. You're a sole source of calm while providing great data-driven information. Recently made starter positions in Intel and Vornado. Hoping my timing is reasonable. Do you think there's a better option to these sectors? Looks like a good time to load up significantly here on those, though it is worth pacing allocation in weeks ahead due to more weakness possible, especially with REITs. Also, I was unlucky that I hadn't discovered you when you positioned so well in Range Resources and Comstock. I've started a small Comstock allocation and would appreciate your thoughts on 2 points of current Comstock levels. $10 are worth leaning into more now, or if that would be premature if you see more weakness ahead. Is there potential for Comstock multi-bagger going forward? Thanks as always, Drew. All right. So, Vornado is a tricky situation. Look, these things are, like, if you ask people what's the one thing you don't want to own, going back to Carl Icahn, if you would say what's the craziest thing you could buy right now would be commercial office REITs. I think Vornado is interesting. You got to manage Vornado by your size. This can't be a heavyweight in the portfolio, but I like it. I like this hairiness. I love this puking action. Even if it goes down to $10, it's going to rebound. You can't bet against Steve Roth. And the big thing here is this is like malls. You have Simon Property Group, who weathered when all the B malls went belly up and they were toast. Simon Property held tight. They've got the Lululemons. They've got the Apple stores in every single mall, and they've got wealthy people. It's the exact same thing with Boston Properties and Vornado. These are the creme de la creme of office properties. The problem is they're the most well-known of office properties. So the fact that everyone's nervous about lease renewal and everything else, they're going to get hit. Their vacancy is going to go down. The question is, how much is priced in with the stock down 75% and the assets still being the premier assets in the greatest cities in the country, namely New York City? And you know, I've got a place on 40th Street on Bryant Park, and I got to say, the city has changed in the last couple of months. I mean, it was depressing the last 2 years to go there. Dirty, you know, people sleeping, all the things you don't want to see. And I'm not saying it's magical or anything like it was during the Giuliani and Bloomberg eras, but I will say there's a market improvement. People are coming back to the city. There is action. There is excitement. There is energy. And it's the greatest city in the world. So Vornado just happens to have the highest quality office properties in the greatest city in the world, which, like every other time and every other cycle, people say will never come back. And I think this time what you're going to find is the people who want to be in the greatest city in the world want to be in the greatest buildings in the greatest city in the world. And if you want to do that, you're going to be in Vornado. And yes, people are going to work remotely 3 days a week, but they still need a desk and a chair when they come in for the 2 days a week or the 3 days a week or what will ultimately become the 4 days a week and maybe back to 5 days a week if the labor market gets softer. Everyone will rush in to go to their jobs. But the fact of the matter is, I think the risk reward is interesting. Could it be a donut hole? Yes. So size it appropriately. But I think more likely than not, you're going to see a dividend cut and then the stock is going to rally. So we think it's interesting. We also think Mortimer Zuckerman over at Boston Properties, you know, his is high. He's got the high tier in Boston. This one hasn't quite fallen as much, but I think it's a similar story. So, you know, if we're going to, I met Steve Roth, like a decade ago. I know who he runs with. I know how he operated through the financial crisis. I know how he thinks. I know how he operates. This guy's not getting taken out on a stretcher. So if I'm going to bet on one of these things, and, you know, risk is commensurate with reward, I'm going to bet on this jockey, just like I'm betting on Gelsinger. And these are hairy situations. But I think when we look 2 or 3 years out, when the dust settles, you got doubles or triples. They meet our IRR standards. We deal with some short-term volatility. We add on weakness. And we go on to the next stage. But if they didn't get wiped out during the great financial crisis, which was much more onerous conditions than right now, I don't see how they're getting wiped out now. But, I could be proven wrong. And, the key is it'll be sized in a way that if I am, we're not going out on a stretcher. And if I'm right, we're going to make a better than it than expected value IRR dramatically over the next few years on this. And we're willing to take that risk reward. And if it goes down to 10, that'll be great. We'll top up and bring our basis down a little bit as well. So by the way, let's just take a look. Maybe I have Fornato here. Yeah, here we go. So let's take a look. The book value is $27 a share. It's trading at 15, which hypothetically means if they liquidated the buildings today, their vacancy rate has gone down from, occupancy rates has gone from 90.3 to in line with 90.4. Their other occupancy is 87.3 down from 89.6. And they've got California Street is down to, 87.3 from 89.6. And then this other one, 555 California Street's at 94.7% occupancy versus 98.1. And yes, well, their average monthly rent's up 3%. That won't continue. So let's assume rents go down. The stock is down 75%. So, you know, you had a book value when it was trading at $63 a share. You had a book value of $28. Now it's trading at $15 a share. You got a book value of $27. So, you know, I mean, you had funds from operations were obviously higher. At 475, 483, you now have it at, you know, 3 to 325. So that's come down, you know, 30 some odd percent, call it 40%. The stock's come down 75%. So, you know, I mean, this is what always happens on overshoots because people extrapolate with recency bias. What happened most recently is going to persist. The revenues, by the way, troughed out in 2020 at $1.3 billion. They're now back up to $1.6 billion, which is down from the peak of $2.1 billion. So yeah, revenues are down 25%. The stock is down 75%. Do you think enough is priced in? Well, no, not if you think revenues are going to go to $800 million. Then no, you shouldn't be buying the stock. We happen to think that they'll probably flatline, you know, $1.5 billion, $1.6 billion for the next couple of years. And then they'll hockey stick because their assets are scarce, greatest buildings in the greatest city in the world. If you think that's going to change and New York is going to be replaced by Miami and there's never going to be a big hurricane in Miami, then God bless. Go live in Miami and good luck. But, you know, we love these things when there's hair and when people think you're a little bit crazy. You're going against the trend. A lot of times events are overblown, overblown on the good side, overblown on the bad side. So all you hear right now is the worst place you could be is commercial real estate. Well, thanks for telling me that 75% ago. I'm interested now that the market's already priced it in, or at least 80% of the problem by the stock trading down 75% with book value being down, you know, 5%. And that book value will come down and all that nonsense. But yes, you have some walking away from buildings that don't make economic sense, et cetera, et cetera. And we see all this stuff. But again, greatest city in the world, greatest buildings in the world. They'll lose a couple buildings, but their balance sheet's strong. They were actually selling ahead of this. So they won't be out in the market buying. Income and revenues will be a little flattish until they're not. And in the meantime, you collect a 10% dividend until it gets cut in half to 5%. And then the stock starts to rally. So that's that. And then finally, I just want to do PayPal. I'm not, you know, enamored in PayPal and it's sized accordingly, but I just want to show you this business because it's down, you know, from $320. Let's see here. Yeah, $310 down to $75. So, you know, I mean, 75-something percent again. I mean, when do you get an opportunity to buy things that are... Anyway, but here's what's happened to the business. Yes, the management didn't meet their expectations and Wall Street got a temper tantrum. But it got a temper tantrum because they paid too much for the stock. Back here, they were all in this bubble territory. Now the business trades at 13 times forward earnings. And by the way, they've been compounding capital at mid-teens for over a decade. Return on capital, shareholder equities, you know, also in the same ballpark. And their operating margins have retained their, low 20s. They've been buying back some stock. Their book values continue to compound. Their earnings per share have continued to grow, with the exception of last year was a big miss. But estimates are that they're going to recover and continue their uptrend line. Their cash flow per share has doubled since 2018. And the business is going to continue to grow. And, you know, Venmo is a verb. PayPal, you know, we run our site on PayPal. Is it the best thing in the world? No, they rip us off. It's fine. But, you know, it's easy. And I think people like easy. And there's a level of switching costs. So, yes, it's a crowded space. So if margins compress, but you're going to have 3-5% inflation for the next few years. The Fed just doesn't want to acknowledge it. And the tickets are going to go up and their margins will be a little bit compressed, but they'll continue to compound. And, you know, buying it at 70 times when everyone wanted it at the top is why they got burned. Buying it at 13 times, it starts to make more sense. As people lick their wounds and the company starts to, they've got management in place. There's a lot of buying support here. We'll see if that holds. I think this one can be okay. Is it a pound the table highest weight? No, but it earned a place, some exposure, and I think it's kind of interesting. So with that said, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. In the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.